Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Retro Raw Rundown here on Inside the Ropes, where we go back 20 years and cover Monday Night Raw, where I relive parts of my childhood, which sometimes is good and sometimes is terrible, and Sondra gets to relive the glory days, Sondra. The glory days of 1997, where rape and kidnapping were commonplace.
Everyone tells me that they're glory days, and I'm refusing to believe it. After having lived through most of 1997 now, I'm just saying maybe rose-colored glasses are a thing for a lot of people like you.
Well, you know, I've brought in someone else this week because this is such a big episode, and there's a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes. So I thought I'd bring in a friend of mine. He worked with me in Hell. He is the author of the Titan series of books, Titan Sinking, Titan Shattered, Titan Screwed, probably in the future Titan Stunned, James Dixon. Hi, James.
Hi, Kenny.
How are
Sondra,
you?
No, never mind all that. Sondra, what do you mean rose-tinted glasses?
Everyone tells me 1997 was the best year in wrestling.
Correct.
Oh my gosh, the Attitude Era is going to be forming. It's going to be amazing. Everything's so great. You know what I have found in 1997? The Stalker left me. The Sultan's not on TV anymore. Very much like he's in a lumberjack match on this episode, but he's not very prominent. There's rape and kidnapping going on. Not a huge fan of that. Shawn Michaels is a prick that I just want off my television. The Godwins are the tag team champions. Like, how in the world is this the best year of wrestling? I don't understand.
I mean, I can't defend the Godwins, but everything else seems pretty good to me. I mean, what? You don't know who's going to turn up from one week to the next. The matches are good. You've got the rise of
the matches aren't good. The matches aren't good.
Well, no, they're not good. But they're in the
they're not! The wrestling is bad! Like, overall, the wrestling is bad in 1997.
Yeah, but it wasn't about the wrestling. If you're watching 97 for the wrestling, then I don't know what we're doing here.
I never once said, I want to have this out, because Sondra will always make out, you know, 97 is not the best. I never said, Sondra, let's go back to 1997 to watch lots of great wrestling. There was never
no,
an argument.
Obviously it's all about the story.
And also the thing is, listen, whatever you say, you got to experience almost 7 months of Psycho Sid. How can you be angry?
I'm not angry about that, but Psycho Sid has left me too, so maybe I'm just in this state of, you know, some of my favorites are gone now, and it's upsetting.
I think the bigger issue is who your favorites are, you know? You've got the Heart Foundation, Steve Austin, and DX there, and you're mourning the loss of the Stalker. I mean, come on.
It's pretty much me in a nutshell, isn't it?
I feel like this is like when somebody at school is reading like a point crime horror book, and then like a really big author's coming up to the door going, "You don't know what you're talking about."
I would never say someone doesn't know what they're talking about when it comes to wrestling, because it's all subjective anyway. But in this case, I'm close.
It is interesting though to hear Sondra's take on a lot, because there is stuff that like, you think when you watch it back that it was good. And there's a lot of stuff that is, but there's some stuff you go, oh, fuck, that's not good.
And to be fair, there is a lot of stuff that's good. There is a lot of story stuff that's good. I like the chaotic feel of 1997. I like the fact that it does feel like anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation, right? Because with injuries and people quitting and getting fired and dying now, they have to rearrange on the fly. And so, well, yeah. But... So I appreciate the chaotic nature of it, and it does feel more authentic than today's wrestling. But just in terms of actually like wanting to watch wrestling matches, and some of the stories don't actually make loads of sense. Like, I mean, anytime they try to have a tournament, it gets all fucked up. Anytime, like, I don't even know what's going on with the tag team division, because like nothing is going on with the tag team division right now.
There's
which is
a lot of injuries, though. You know, like 97 was really bad for injuries, like more than any other year that I can remember. I don't know about you, Kenny. You know, but with you know, like Brett and Austin both getting injured at various different points in the year, and Shawn getting injured constantly.
What I would say is, I think that 97, what it's really good at is that it kind of turns all these negatives into something else very quickly, and it doesn't really feel like. Like, I mean, Owen Hart and Farouk is such a strange match as an IC title main event. But, like, yeah, I mean, when there seems to be injuries all the time. Like, Ahmed Johnson just gets injured every week.
Ahmed Johnson
that was his gimmick, though.
Yeah, that was his gimmick of injury. But so obviously we've talked about Bad Blood on Patreon. There's a thing on Patreon as well of us talking about what led up to that with Brian Pillman, his death and all that. So, but James, before we talk about Raw, there was some stuff that happened behind the scenes on this day before the show started. What happened that was quite significant at this point?
Okay, so obviously the mood backstage was quite somber, you know, given what happened the night before. But basically they had a meeting where Vince McMahon admitted that, and his exact quote was, maybe time's passed me by, and some of the old formulas that have been successful for so long are outdated, so from this point forwards we're going to be geared towards a more mature fan base. So that speech to the whole locker room was basically the start, you know, day one of the Attitude Era. I mean, they'd been getting to that point for a long time, you know, for a couple of years really, Vince had been building towards that. But that was the day when he finally let everybody else in on, you know, the thing he already knew that they were going to be doing. A lot of people weren't happy about it either.
Like, I'm guessing like Brett and those sort of people. And again, what's interesting is because Brett got told, yeah. Brett's told on the day of the Madison Square Garden Raw that Vince wants out of the contract. And then they're going back and forth. Yeah. So what? Yeah. So at this point, the day after Bad Blood, where is the situation like with Brett at this point, on this day?
Oh, he's gone by this point. You know, that's already done because we're into the final throes of his run there. So he's already out. Vince already knows he's out. The fact that he was in a, you know, a mid-card tag match at the pay-per-view, and you know, for he was in the mid-card for his whole title run, kind of shows you that. You know, he had Triple H on this show as well, right? And I guess we'll get to that in a bit, but
unfortunately,
it wasn't great. Very few meetings between them, though. But yeah, I think that Brett was supposed to get pinned, but he got counted out in the end.
By Hunter?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, because obviously they wanted to just beat him like a drum on the way out, you know? As they did with everybody who was leaving, but then there was the whole creative control thing, and Brett was like, no, I won't be doing the job for you.
Well, good for Bret Hart, because right. Honestly, he should not be pinned by Hunter Hearst Helmsley on this episode of Raw. He's the fucking champion.
He is the champion, but I suppose they wanted to push Hunter to be the next guy, or you know, to be the guy at some point down the line. It happened a couple of times where Bret wouldn't lose to him.
No wonder.
Difficult though.
Brett was difficult, and you can tell. I mean, you can even see it now, just from all the years past. And there's no bigger Bret Hart fan than Bret Hart, but well, apart from us,
apart from us, right?
Pre 2010. So the thing that's interesting about the show is they obviously do the 10-bell salute to Pillman at the start of the show. Vince is in the ring. He's talking about, you know, what's happened, and there's a picture of Pillman on the Tron, and all the wrestlers are out there. Even Marlena is out there. But the people conspicuous by their absence are The Undertaker, Shawn Michaels, and Helmsley. So I get The Undertaker thing, because he's never done anything like this. He's always kind of been backstage. But what was the reason that Shawn... Was there any sort of like heat on Shawn and Hunter for not doing it, or were they just kind of like...
Oh, man, there was a ton. Like, all of the boys already hated both of them anyway. You know, 97 was Shawn at his worst. His absolute worst. And Hunter had stopped... You know, with the pretense that he was one of the boys by then, and they politicked to be together on screen because it was the only way they'd be happy and do business. And everybody hated them anyway. So when they didn't come out for that tribute, the boys were not really surprised, but still as appalled as they should have been. I think the only defense for them is that they were in the opening segment immediately afterwards, and it didn't make sense for them to do one than the other. But, you know, fuck kayfabe when it's... someone's actually died, you know? Ignore the storylines. It doesn't matter. It's a separate thing that exists on the show but isn't part of the show when they do the tributes.
Well, Vince even says when he opens up the show and says, you know, oh, the superstars have put their differences aside for this because obviously, like, this is more important than, you know, their differences or their issues that are going on right now between the characters. And so to have Shawn and Hunter not be part of it, like, I didn't notice that they weren't a part of it because I was more just kind of intrigued by the fact that, like, Goldust and Marlena were out there. But it just kind of seems like, why wouldn't you be? Because, like, they have between, like, they have the intro after this, right? Like, the whole, like, rawr, fire ropes attitude era intro is between the tribute and the opening segment. So there was time for them to go back and then just start the show as normal.
And even if, you know, would it even matter if they just stayed there and just walked to the ring as if it was immediately following? Would it really make that big a difference? I mean, if Goldust and Marlena are out there, and they've been feuding with him and doing all these angles with him, and
she's been raped by him.
She's been raped. Yes. Well, maybe, but
she has been raped by him.
No, but has she?
Well, you know how you think back about the Brian Pillman stuff, right? And I've got a friend who legitimately has pitched me stories about Sheamus being in the IRA. He's talked about how a car bomb should blow up the telephone box at a London Raw. Right? He's went into details of very, very insensitive storylines.
Yeah, concerning, right?
But he and I went to school with him, so we would watch wrestling at the same time. I remember the Pillman Goldust stuff being quite bad, but when I'm watching it back now, and then also, no offense, when I'm watching it with a woman, and you're kind of like, oh, so, yeah, how about that? And then you watch all the segments, it leads up to those Triple X files where she basically looks like she, you know, she's at the corner of the bed, like, you know, crawling away, and he's like talking about her being a pig and stuff. And then, so the test of it was, I thought, I'm going to ask my friend Jamie what he thinks of it. Because he's a deplorable human being. So if he likes this, then, you know, that there you go. So I said to him, I said, what do you think about this? And he said, it's fucking disgusting, isn't it? I was like, he's yeah. disgusted. That's
I mean, if Jamie Miller is disgusted, that says something. It just does.
But I think it was disgusting as you saw it in the context. But I think if it had been allowed to develop,
play out, yeah.
It would have. Yeah, I think what would have happened there is that Terry would have been playing along with Brian the whole time. So she wasn't raped. You know, she just made it look like she was. And for what reason, I don't know. But that's from what I gather where they were going with that.
And I think like, it's a shame that didn't, not just because he died, but it's a shame that didn't happen because, like, now the story, like, the last thing that Brian Pillman ever did in wrestling was kidnap a woman and basically hold her hostage for 30 days. Like, that's his last thing.
It kind of fit his gimmick, though. You know, he'd done a lot of things that were nearly as bad as that over the few years preceding. So, I mean, pulling out a gun and saying fuck on Raw probably was amongst them.
They were losing a ratings war. They had to do something. Why not get a gun?
Like, almost get kicked off the network? That'll help.
Well, that's not really what happened, though. But
so what was the real story behind that, then? What happened? What was the story with the gun? Was it under the USA Network made Vince apologize or something about it?
They did, but they were in on the whole deal beforehand. So Raw moved its time slot that day so it could compete with Nitro better. So Nitro didn't have the jump on it anymore. And as a way of doing that, and because I believe it was like one of the season premieres or something, it was something along those lines. It was they wanted this Raw to be big and memorable and different. So he, Vince, that is, got together with the USA Network and told them what he was going to do. USA had people there when they were doing the rehearsals and everything, so they knew what was happening. They saw the script. The only things they wanted taken out were when Brian or Steve put their hands on Melanie. There was something there where she'd, you know, get bumped over the couch, I think it was. So they wanted that taken out, and they wanted something else taken out. I think it was pointing the gun directly at the camera or actually shooting the gun on screen. Because it goes to black, doesn't it, when he shoots?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you would have seen him pull the trigger on the original script. So USA saw all of that. And then it happened, and obviously it got a shit ton of publicity.
They washed their hands
Vince
of it.
Loved. And, well, basically, Vince was dragged into the USA office, and all the people who knew about it were now getting a lot of heat from above, or from in different directions, sponsors and the like. So they made the WWF apologize for that. But they were all secretly thrilled, because it created this big buzz, and they were all about creating the big buzz. So they didn't even get kicked off the network. They conspired with the network to create this controversial thing that they both then apologized for, but were not sorry for at all.
Wrestling. I still think that the real hero of the gun spot was Kevin Kelly, who was such a great reporter that he refused to leave the scene.
I know,
of
right?
a gun. I would be out there so fast. Anyway, so we opened the show with Sean and Hunter in China and Rick Rude coming out. Baby Michael Cole is in the ring. They basically gave Michael Cole a wedgie. Then Hunter is just like such an arsehole. You know, he's like holding on to like Michael Cole as if he's like the school bully and the jock and all that sort of stuff. They start just putting themselves over. Hunter says, you know, who's the main event? Who's the icon? And Shawn Michaels keeps saying, me. Then they show the incident from Madison Square Garden on the Tron with the...
First time as well, right?
Yeah, so they'd never shown that before, and it goes, and it cuts to Vince, and they're kind of like, you know, they're egging on Vince, and they're saying, and Shawn's saying, you know, what's the matter, Vince? You know, you looked like an ass long before I came along and made one of you, or whatever, and I mean, this what this looks like is that Vince McMahon and Shawn Michaels clearly were having sex.
Yes.
Shawn Michaels is now having sex with Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and Vince is very jealous.
I mean, in my head, that's exactly the story that went on backstage. I was actually talking about this with a pal last night. I was like, it is a shame there was no Total Divas type show back then that could have followed the exploits of Vince McMahon and Shawn Michaels and, you know, the torrid love affair between them. And then, you know, when Shawn leaves Vince for Hunter Hearst Helmsley, like all of the rage and emotion that could have been, I mean, seriously, that would have been a story.
Some of the boys really think that happened, you know. Some of the boys genuinely think that Vince and Shawn were fucking. You know, a couple of guys in shoot interviews have said it. I do not think that was happening, but a lot of people are convinced it was.
I mean, there's definitely an argument there. I did just want to say, quickly, in case MD's not read any of these Titan books, James has written these three books so far about really getting into depth of WWF in 1995, 1996, and 1997. And you've pretty much spoke to everybody that's accessible that was around, right?
Everyone who's still alive.
Yeah, so...
apart from Vince, yeah.
Yeah, apart from Vince and stuff. But, you know, everybody who was around at this point, so when he's giving you this information, it's coming from people on the inside. So, Shawn and Hunter show this this click... I guess, Sandra, this must have been, like, not that shocking for you because you've seen the click footage, like, a million times now, right? So it's not, it doesn't really mean the same thing to you.
It doesn't, but I understand how it must have come across in context because, I mean, I've said on this show before, if you don't know who the clique are, like, it still doesn't make all that much sense that they're saying, you know, oh, the clique-ness, and this is a, you know, proper hello from the clique to Michael Cole as they're giving him a wedgie and noogies and all sorts of stuff. Like, they're just acting like assholes, basically. And then, you know, showing the footage of the curtain call. I don't know how much of the audience actually would understand what was going on. I mean, they're basically just trying to, you know, rip away kayfabe or whatever and say, like, hey, this is the reason the Hunter Hearst Helmsley wasn't pushed for a year. And they're, like, complaining about his spot on the card, and it's all very meta. And it doesn't come across well to me, even though I know what's going on. I just kind of am like, this isn't even entertaining. This is just you guys out there amusing yourselves and being assholes. And it's not even fun to watch. Like, the whole call and response thing of them just being like, who's the icon? Who's da da da? Like, I get that I'm not supposed to like them, but I just really want to turn off the television when they're on. Like, I want to fast forward these segments. I don't want, even when the Hart Foundation came out, like, I think it's to the detriment of this segment just how annoying and how much of a prick Hunter's being, and Shawn too, obviously, like both of them together are just awful because, you know, Brett's trying to talk and, you know, advance a segment and advance a story, and they're just talking over him and being like, oh, they're burying me, nah, 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 nah. And I don't know, it takes away from it for me because it takes me out of the moment, out of the story, and it just makes me go, these guys are just not even out here trying to be professional at all.
Brett's just as bad, though, when he calls Triple H a homo.
Oh, that was terrible, too. I was not a fan of that.
Well, I have some stuff on that. I have some stuff on the homo. But before we do, very quickly, I want to say, like, somebody in our Facebook community said, you know, oh, I'm so glad we're watching now because it gets much better. And it's like, yeah, it does till Survivor Series, and then the rest of 1997 is dog shit. Like, December 97, I almost stopped
it's the
watching.
Worst.
Oh, it's so bad.
I think
bad.
This Raw is one of the most important Raws ever. I think it's amazing, this episode.
It's definitely very significant, and it's yeah. I think that it definitely, I felt like it had a good direction going in it for most of the stuff, but I do kind of agree, like, with Sandra, like, when I was watching this, I was just like, I mean, they are just, maybe I'm in the minority. I think Shawn Michaels and Triple H and DX in 97 are awful. I don't know.
Did you think that at the time, though?
Yeah, I remember at one point, I remember my mum coming into the room and like there's a December 97, I'm just going to give this away, Sondra, you're not going to care anyway, where Sean Hunter start playing strip poker in the middle of the ring.
Great.
And my mum just came in and went, what the fuck are you watching? And I was like, I don't know. I actually don't know. And I think that's, like, because the whole, you know, it's funny, Stephanie McMahon was on Lorraine Kelly this week and she said, you know, we're storytelling, like a great book or a great, you know, opera or whatever. And, but like with Sean, it's just, it feels like Sean is getting to have his way over everything. And there's not, it doesn't feel like that's what's meant to happen. It just feels like every week he railroads himself into going off script or to say what he wants to say or...
Maybe, but what about the meeting that had that day, though? Like, Vince has asked for something, he wants reality, and then... So they've gone, okay, fuck it, we'll give you reality. And they've gone out and given reality.
I think for a lot of people that was good, but I don't think that Shawn Michaels needed to give us more reality at that point. I think he'd given us enough with all of his drug appearances, but... So Sondra, so Brett comes out with the Hart Foundation, and Brett says, you know, Sean, you're nothing but a degenerate. You're standing there with the guy in the green shirt, and I'm sure the HHH stands for homo, homo, homo. And then maybe one of my favorite lines I've ever heard in wrestling, and I didn't even remember this. Brett says that Shawn Michaels may have barebacked his way to one pay-per-view main event after another.
Well, again, that's that whole Sean and Vince fucking thing.
And I was,
I mean, that's immediately what I thought. I was like, this just supports my theory.
So I've got some more stuff to back up this. So earlier on today, I was recording the PowerSlam podcast with Finn, and I was telling him, you know, what we're doing tonight. And I said, you know, I said, it's mad that, like, you know, Brett's calling Hunter a homo and blah, blah. And Finn was saying, well, he interviewed Brett in 98. Brett had a defense to this promo. And his defense was he legitimately believed that Sean and Vince were fucking. So he felt no remorse in saying homo, 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 because he was like, he is! Because Hunter's probably fucking Sean, and Sean's
still
fucking
it's
Vince.
The tone, though, isn't it?
Oh, no, the tone's terrible, but like that...
The tone's terrible, because, I mean, it's classic Bret Hart homophobia running rampant, right? Because, I mean, he's done this before,
and this gets lost in translation. People don't ever talk about Bret Hart's rampant homophobia.
It is everywhere throughout his promos. It is everywhere throughout his promos. Like when he's talking to Sean, when he's talking about Goldust, when he's talking about anybody, right? And it's very clear that Bret Hart had a lot of homophobia. I mean, the insinuation is like, you know, we know what the HHH stands for in HBK. You're nothing but a homo. And that guy there in the green shirt is nothing but a homo. And of course, Triple H's very quick response is, oh, I'm no queer because, you know, being queer is the worst thing you can possibly be. That's like the biggest insult he can possibly think of, is to be like, ha ha, you sleep with men. And 1997.
My favorite thing is Scott.
20 years ago, though. You know, mindsets and that kind of thing.
In 97, sadly, that was more fair game. But, like, if I remember Scott Hall did an interview and he was talking about Vince, and he said that Vince sat him down one day and said, let me tell you about my first homosexual experience. And Sean said, and Scott Hall said, as opposed to your most recent. Which, I know. So, you know, there's a theory that Vince swings both ways. I mean, to be honest, that would not surprise me.
That
goes for a lot of the boys, you know?
Yeah.
That goes for a lot of people in wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
It's never really talked about, and we won't really talk about it now either, but that's not an uncommon thing, I don't believe.
I mean, Vince McMahon... Good God, imagine Vince and Sean in a porno. Jesus Christ. So, Brett...
the rest of the evening ruined with that image.
And if anyone,
I'm surprised no one's made that porno. I would be surprised if that porno doesn't exist somewhere. And if it doesn't,
and
well,
I think...
I'm saying, like, you know, not with actual Vince and actual Sean, but you know,
and you know that Vince would want to be the top, but reluctantly he'd bottom for Sean because Sean wouldn't allow himself to be the bottom because he'd go in a huff.
I mean, that's so clearly their dynamic, though.
Should we move on to Bret Hart's character?
Sure. Do you don't enjoy our brief positioning theories about Sean and Vince?
I mean, I need to eat my dinner later, you know. And now I'm going to be thinking about Vince and Sean just going at it over a barrel or something.
And also, just to back up the theory even further, when Sonny was a guest at Inside the Ropes with the 25 people that paid to get in that I lost money on, we all make our mistakes, of which I've made many, but. She said on stage, she said that Shawn Michaels used to like to fuck her up the ass in small closets or rooms in an arena, and do it while there was a mirror, and he liked her to apply lipstick and then smear it over her face like the Joker.
I was actually just thinking, I wonder if Sean made Vince put on the lipstick.
Anyway, sorry, James, we do not want to come between you and your dinner. So
no, that's fine. I understand what I've let myself into here.
But so here's what I'm interested though, is Brett comes out, and you know, this is going to be a bit of a free-for-all of conversations. No point in us trying to be like, one, two, three, speak. We'll just all chime in when we want to. But what I found interesting about this was Brett comes out and cuts the promo, and the thing is, like, homophobia aside, I think everybody's kind of on Brett's side. Because even people, like, Sean and Hunter are so deplorable. So Brett comes out and does this promo, but then Brett's supposed to be a heel. Because he's supposed to be
Mr.
Canada.
He even tells the crowd, he's like, you know, you can save your cheers or whatever. Which was awkward to me, because I was like, I really do want to be on Brett's side. I mean, I don't appreciate the rampant homophobia, but I also don't appreciate the rampant whatever it is Sean and Hunter are doing. But Brett still doesn't want the crowd to cheer him for some reason. So this is heel versus heel, which is another reason this isn't quite working for me.
So James, yeah,
what's weird, don't you think? I mean, previously to this episode, Brett had always been the heel because he was anti-America. And there'd never been, he'd always kept that moral core that's associated with the Bret Hart character. In terms of, you know, when he was in Canada, he was still a good guy, and he was only a bad guy in America because he was against America, that kind of thing. Whereas here, he's just full on homophobic slurs, and, you know, it's completely different, and it's very obviously, to me anyway, character assassination from the WWF, because they know where he's going, and they're like, right, let's cut this guy down and make him, you know, a shell of himself when he leaves.
Also, what's interesting is, and I never really thought about this beforehand, because you've watched a lot of this stuff back more recently when you've done the books, right? Like, you've watched
all
of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've not. Like, I've not really watched. I've watched bits and pieces, but see, when I'm watching it back, the thing that kind of strikes me is, it almost feels like One Night Only was the moment that the stories broke. Because you had Bulldog, who lost in his hometown with his dying sister, and Sean wins. And then, you know, you get to America on the Monday, and they show this big video package of what Shawn Michaels did to Bulldog. And then up next, Bulldog's coming out, but then now he's supposed to be a heel because he's facing Vader, who's representing America. And it all just becomes quite broken.
Yeah. They already knew by One Night Only that Brett was going, or Vince did anyway. So, like, he'd already made that decision by then. So it was a reboot and a reset of various things, just without really letting on to Brett or the rest of the guys in the Hart Foundation that was happening. Because they couldn't talk about it. Like, Vince couldn't talk about it to anybody because of, you know, it's contract negotiations have to be kept private. If it gets out, then they've got big problems. So he was just putting the pieces where he wanted them to be, covertly.
There we go. So yeah, basically this promo ends with Brett Scott Hunter in the main event tonight. Brett said that he ran their pals Razor and Diesel at the WWF, and he'll do the same to Sean Hunter. And then Brett says something that, like, Sean calls Brett a paper champion, and he has a supporting role in his pay-per-views. And then Brett says that he earns more money than all three of them. And it felt like it got really real at the end there.
That one hurt Sean, because Sean was so pissed that Brett was earning double what he was earning. Because Sean was on $750 a year, and Brett was on $1.5 million a year. And Sean had a discussion a few weeks earlier, during the time when Vince decided that he needed to get rid of one of them, and Brett cost more money and he was older, so it was Brett. You know, he'd said to Vince, like, he ain't worth two of me, you know, he's not worth half of me, kind of thing. And which at that time probably was true. Like, Sean in the ring was the best in the world. I fully believe that. But obviously came with his outside-the-ring issues, whereas Brett was reliable but slowing down. And Sean was so pissed with the fact that Brett earned more than him. So pissed. So, and Brett knew that. So when Brett starts saying he earns more money, yeah, it's getting real now. They're completely off script, and they're just shooting on each other. They're trying to piss each other off.
And it seems to be working. And again, I kind of almost feel like it's to the detriment of the segment, because, like, yeah, it is interesting, Brett saying, like, yeah, I earn more money than you, and Sean getting pissed about it. But as an audience member, as a fan, I'm just kind of like, where is this going exactly? And I don't really want to hear about contract negotiations and financial reports. Like, that's not why I tune into wrestling.
I think why it was interesting in 97, though, was none of this stuff had ever happened before. So, like, it was more just like, oh, this is different. And the thing was that I remember kind of watching at the time going, Sean and Brett Survivor Series, and I was like, I just don't know who's going to win. But then I wasn't reading, you know, the Observer ends. I didn't know anything. I was reading Power Slam, but even in Power Slam...
Vince didn't know who was going to win. That was the problem.
yeah, true. For the creative control. But anyway, so we're going to get Brett and Hunter on the main event and Sean and the Clicker raging. Up next, Sondra, to your delight, we have the WWF Tag Team Champions, the Godwins.
Okay, but like, why? Why are they the Tag Team Champions? I'm still mad.
With
still
Uncle mad. Cletus in their corner, because, you know, the only thing that can make the Godwins better is a revamped TL Hopper. get up against the Headbangers. Fucking hell. And we've got Lumberjacks. I mean, to be fair, it was very short, and all the Lumberjacks jump in at one point. There's a big brawl, and then Mosh rolls up Phineas and gets the three count. So it was quick and painless, and the Headbangers won. So I guess it's the least.
It wasn't painless. It wasn't painless.
I mean, nothing with the Godwins is painless.
No, never, because they're the Godwins, and they're on my television, and they shouldn't be, and I'm pretty raging about it. I did notice there are four Truth Commission people now.
So now the other guy's the Jackal. The Commandant
right.
is gone.
But we haven't met the Jackal yet. Four guys in the shirts.
We meet him next week.
You will love him by November, December, when he's doing 20-minute promos every week.
Oh,
great.
From a pulpit. He's now the commentator for New Japan, and he's great. He really is. He's really good.
I just love the career trajectory of, right, okay, he's in a tag team with Rick Martel in Canada, he becomes the Jackal, he goes to ECW and becomes Cyrus, then he co-hosts a podcast with Lance Storm, then he becomes one of the lead commentators from New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Well, it's an obvious career trajectory, isn't it?
I mean, how else could it really go?
I'm just
angry that this match wasn't for the titles, though. Because
you thought there was a chance of the Headbangers getting the belts back from the Godwins.
Yes, I did. Because I thought, you know, it's the night after, then, you know, maybe the Headbangers can get a rematch for the belts that they just lost to the Godwins by nefarious means, nonetheless, like, because fucking Uncle Cletus has to insert himself into the proceedings. And I was like, yeah, maybe the Headbangers can get the belts back. That would be great, because I like the Headbangers. And nope. They win. They pin a Godwin. But they don't get their belts back, which means the Godwins are still the champions, which means more Godwins matches, which means I am not happy.
They were popular backstage, though. Especially Phineas.
I don't give a fuck. They're not popular on my TV.
Yeah, but it's all politics, though, isn't it? You know, like, Undertaker's got his group. They're both part of it. Sean's got his group. You've got to keep Taker happy, so you push his friends. You know,
oh, so this is the Undertaker's fault. Well, then.
Oh, don't bring this up. God. She was just starting to be okay with him.
He's giving me more fuel, Kenny. He's giving me more fuel.
The Undertaker hasn't gone to Vince and said, you need to put the tag titles on the Godwins. But Vince has thought, you know what? I'll keep the peace. I'll push some of the guys from Undertaker's faction. I'll push some of the guys from Brett's. Some of the guys from Shawn's. Everyone will be happy. But no one's happy.
Do you think,
especially not the fans.
Do you think part of it is that... Because obviously Undertaker was like the kind of moral compass of backstage, right? Like he was the guy that kind of... The locker room leader and all that. Do you think... Is part of pushing the Godwins to this extent almost trying to let Butter take it up because when the whole Survivor Series thing goes down, Vince wants to have Taker on site?
No, because at this point the screw job didn't exist.
But not even the screw job, just the whole situation. Like he knows when Brett leaves that if everyone hates Sean, that he at least wants Taker to kind of be, you know, on exactly. Vince's side. So is that maybe like a little political move?
Potentially. I mean,
you can't just win. Do you know what? We've got LOD, we've got various tag teams, we've got the Headbangers. But
LOD were old, man. Like that's the thing. They got repackaged a couple of months later because Vince Russo got it in his head that they were old and past it and no one give a shit, but which is just not true. Like, the reactions to LOD are always huge.
Even on this show. They're,
yeah, know, even on this show, because they do the great. Running done in this match.
I mean, I thought the Lumberjack thing was fine. I liked the big brawl.
I liked Hawk patting Mosh's shoulder at one point as a means of comfort.
we get this, so obviously we'll not talk about the Brian Pillman, the Melanie Pillman thing till later, but we do get various shots of Brian Pillman's home. At one point you see a Power Slam magazine framed on the wall. Which, it's funny because at this point it doesn't feel as disgusting as it goes on to feel later on.
It will. But James, I mean, you're still building up to the macabre, aren't you?
You are, yeah. The chainsaw is being put on.
And it does feel very jarring that they're going to his home, right? I mean, the last time we saw his home was, you know, the whole gun thing. So it feels very weird to be going back to that scene. And also, like, I know that the man is not alive anymore, and that's obviously going to put a wrench in the storytelling, but, you know, we've been seeing Brian Pillman in this horrendous story with Goldust and Marlena, and now we're just talking about his wife. Like, it's very jarring to just bring his actual real-life wife on, and even before they bring her on screen, it just kind of feels like, wait, so now we're going to go talk to his wife, even though he's been kidnapping and raping Marlena for a month, I guess?
We will get to all of that in a little bit, but James, I want you to answer a question for us that we're not quite sure of.
Sure,
because it's not been explained on television.
Is it something to do with Miguel Perez?
I mean, it's to do with all of them.
So
the Barriquas are all sort of like salsa dancers with hats, right? They've got their white trousers on. They've got whatever, and then all of a sudden now they're like extras in a Coolio music video.
Yeah.
But there's no explanation as to this sudden garment change that they have. Can you shed some light on this?
Was this the first time they changed them, this episode?
No, they had them on last week, but, well, last week it was only Jesus and Jose who came out in different gear, but there's no explanation as to why all of a sudden they have completely different gear and are kind of changing their style.
I mean, it's just part of the move towards edginess, isn't it? I mean, for all the meeting happened the day before this episode, the movement to become edgy and for Attitude to exist before it had a name, it already happened. So Los Barriquas, as they were,
I love the idea that, like, so Mick Foley's not on this show, and so you want to start having, you know, sort of Attitude here, and you go, I tell you what we need to do, we need to toughen up those Barriquas.
Put the Barriquas in cargo pants, man. That's definitely
a stereotype,
the trick.
Aren't there? And that's Vince's go-to.
It is his go-to. But we get Miguel Perez featuring back here, taking on the returning.
He's in a shirt now. Miguel Perez in a shirt is an upgrade.
That is true.
Smaller tank top. The more covered Miguel Perez is, the better.
He's the shit, isn't he?
He's terrible.
He's terrible.
So bland.
Do you know, so I'd never seen, my mom only got a Sky. Like, we only were able to get it when we moved house in, like, June of 97. So before that, I was always getting, like, tapes of, like, Livewire or Mania or whatever. So I'd never seen, because it was one of the Raws in April that we were watching, that Miguel Perez was a babyface having a match in just a pair of pants. My God, that was the most, I mean, raping of the eyes, having to watch that.
It was dire. Jesus. It was
speaking of eye raping, Mark Merrow then, this is his first match in 7 months.
So Sandra, the last time you saw him, he was the Wild Man Mark Merrow.
Gotten rid of his hair.
He didn't get to do his heel turn before, which he was going to do. So he's back now. He's with Sable. He's got a boxer gimmick. JR is pretty interestingly on commentary, kind of saying, you know, this is Mark Merrow's last shot. He's got to make it now. Blah 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 blah. What did you think of the return of Mark Merrow? And is he more interesting to you now as this character than he was as the Wild Man?
I mean, I don't really know what his character is. He just kind of came out with Sable in this, you know, cat suit, basically, that's just all black and shiny and has one sleeve on it, and she has an actual whip with her. Because, of course,
edgy.
She does, I guess.
Need to be edgy.
Because edgy. Sable is just not my cup of tea, okay? So, like, she's horrendous, right?
So
like, she can't emote.
You have to be a 14-year-old boy, that's why.
Yeah, that's
apparently,
a demographic.
She's just so not my type. But... like, I don't understand, like, I get why they put her in sunglasses, because she's so bad at emoting, right? That they're like, well, let's just hide some more of her face so that we can kind of just pretend and then, you know, only just focus on the fact that she's, you know, a walking pair of tits, essentially, is how they're presenting her. But, I mean, as far as Mark Merrow, the match wasn't, I would say the match was fine, but I mean, it had Miguel Perez in it, so it, like, really wasn't fine. It was, you know, it was short. Not that much happened in it.
Oh, just punches, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
punch,
I mean,
punch,
it's
punch.
Just punch, punch, punch. Mark Merrow wins. I sort of drifted off and forgot to pay attention as to how he won or why, and couldn't be bothered rewinding it to figure it out. Mark Merrow does look different, though. He looks significantly different than the last time we saw him. He looks
bigger.
Yeah, he's a lot
wonder
bigger.
Wonder how he's done that.
Yeah, right. And he, you know, he's changed his hair. He's not as smiley. He just, this was bland. It was very bland.
Changed his moveset, doesn't fly around.
Yeah, he's not doing the wild thing.
He gives a shit about him. He was terrible in this era. Terrible.
I did like the TKO.
Okay. It wasn't, he used to do the 450 though.
Yeah, he used to do the wild thing.
Yeah.
Better
than TKO, man.
I see. The thing is, Sondra loves the Stalker, but one of my guilty pleasures in wrestling is when Mark Mero eventually goes heel. He's so delightfully rubbish that I just enjoy him. Like, because there's nothing better than this is not spoiling anything for you, Sondra, but like eventually when he gets jealous of Sable and he's trying to like get the attention away from her,
mm-hmm.
It's so good because he's just such a prick. Like, you know, yay, I won, and nobody cares.
He did play that role well.
He did play the role very well. Because he just kind of... I think he got it. Like, he got, like, all right, okay.
Oh, he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Like, and he wanted his wife to do well, so of course he's going to put her up over.
And then she fucking... And now she's getting pumped by Lesnar. But anyway. We get the first one of Jim Cornette's speeches where, you know, and, you know, they show him earlier on kind of saying, you know, I've got a lot of stuff to say. Eric Bischoff, I'm going to talk about him. So... He talks a lot about, you know, talents like Ric Flair and Mankind getting overlooked in favour of the NWO, and talks about the NWO being childish, obnoxious adolescents. Kevin Nash, the 40-year-old man, tried to act like a teenager. He's only got 6 moves, which Cornette found out when he had to get Glenn Jacobs to try and replicate them.
Including the hair flip.
Scott Hall, you know, who was probably the best of the bunch. And then he talks about Sean Waltman, and he said, you know, a guy that one company released to let another one pick him up, which shows you how valuable he is, which is funny in about 6 months. And he says that, you know, Eric Bischoff's the guy who runs WCW. He takes Ted Turner's money and surrounds himself with guys so he can drink beer with them and ride Harleys. And Cornette thinks that Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, and Cactus Jack should be the ones who still got all the attention because they have talent instead of the attention going to the ones who suck up to the boss. This is Jim Cornette, and this is his opinion.
Irony.
So, James, yeah, tell us a little bit about, for the listeners, why did this make air? What was the reasoning behind it? Did Cornette like doing it? What was the script?
Oh, he liked doing it at first. He went on that internet show they had called Bite This, which it was 1997, so nobody was watching.
Was Bite spelled with a Y?
It was spelled with a Y.
I just had a feeling.
Did you know that, or did you just think?
I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
It genuinely was. But basically, he cut this promo just burying everybody that he hated, and he thought no one's going to watch this, I'll just say whatever. But obviously, someone was watching, and Vince was evidently watching, and said, oh, can you bring this to TV? So he did, and he went through this. He did pre-script it, this one. Which he doesn't script his promos, but this one he did because he had to check it with our good friend Jerry McDevitt to make sure he didn't say anything that would be libelous.
Shout out to Jerry, who listens to the podcast every week. Jerry.
Our good friend Jerry, yeah. And then off he went, as only he can. And some of the things he said were true. A lot of them were ironic, given the DX promo we'd seen at the start of the show. And, you know, as you say, with Sean Waltman coming in a bit later, and the fact that he's going, you know, you've got Kevin Nash, who's 40-year-old. It's like, Bret Hart's 40-year-old, you know, and he's the champion. So, it was a great, great speech. I mean, it's corny, isn't it? You know, he's motor-mouthed and brilliant.
He is, yeah. It's I remember at the time when he was mentioned, it just came like, oh God, he's mentioned in the NWO, and he's mentioning all these people that they never mentioned before. And yet you just
I found it interesting that he mentioned guys like Arn Anderson, Ric Flair, and Cactus Jack. So he's not just talking about guys in WCW that deserve more attention. He's also talking about a guy within their own company who he believes deserves more attention than maybe some of the people who are on top. I mean, he's not actually taking a dig at Shawn Michaels or Bret Hart.
Yet.
But, okay, yeah. Sure. But, you know, just it so kind of came across that way.
He does have equal... He does get to Shawn, thankfully.
Good. Because I cannot wait to hear it. And but, I mean, it was interesting to hear this, for sure. Like, hear the other company discuss so openly. Because, I mean, nowadays, it's very rare that they mention another wrestling company on air. Like, every once in a while, they'll talk about... you know, AJ Styles having been in New Japan or something, but they're never going to, like, really, I mean, it's because there is no actual competition to them now, right? So they don't have to compete. They don't have to call out other companies because they've already won. So this being at a point where they haven't already won, it's interesting to hear them kind of like fire shots this way.
Their mindset was always to ignore the competition, always. But this, again, it's part of that reality drive that they were going for. And Carney intentionally, you know, buried WWE a little bit as well within this, because he knew that if he did that, then people would listen rather than it just being a tirade against WCW, you know, because then people would see him as being fair and down the middle. And he wasn't really, because I think, I can't remember how Carney puts it, Kenny, but I'm sure you can, in one of his many interviews where mm-hmm. he's like, I had to sort of blame them for petty larceny or something like that.
Yep, yep, yep.
And then accuse, sorry, blame us for that, and then blame them for like murder and rape. So. And again, irony to that.
You cannot beat a Cornet rant. That is great.
No.
It's even better when he's doing it on the highway in a car, which you may see one day, you may not. Depending. Anyway, never mind. So up next, we have the British Bulldog going up against Rocky Maivia. The Bulldog's got the Hart Foundation on the outside, Nation of Domination on the outside for Rocky. Quick match where Bulldog pretty kind of easily gets the win with a running power slam. And then after the bell, we have the Nation of Domination and the Hart Foundation having a brawl. Slaughter pulls them apart, and, you know, Farouk clearly is raging that he didn't win the IC title from Owen Hart. I always forget that, like, Bulldog had a match with Rocky Maivia at this point.
Mm. Both heels as well. It was really weird, but fuck the match. The most important thing in this whole thing was Vince going, surely the fans are different. And JR going, don't call me Shirley. Just completely randomly, out of nowhere.
Yep.
It's so deadpan. It's JR at his best. It was fantastic. Popped me for hours.
Sarcastic JR is definitely the best. I mean, This was kind of an odd matchup, right? It's more heel versus heel stuff. And then, like, you know how much I hate agreeing with Jerry the King Lawler, but I found myself agreeing with Jerry the King Lawler, like, a lot during this episode. So I was pretty upset about it. Because Vince is saying, you know, the Hart Foundation has a super different style or something, and how they're wrestling, what you were just mentioning, James, like, he's talking about how they change their style when they're wrestling in the UK or when they're wrestling in Canada, and Lawler's like, no, they're not wrestling a different style, it's just the fans are different, the fans react to them differently. And, you know, and Lawler's like defending the Hart Foundation as super valiant for going on with the show and competing, even though they just lost one of their members, because, you know, Pillman was a member of the Hart Foundation. You'd barely know it in the past month, but he was. And so it's really hard to see the Hart Foundation as heels at this point, because, like, yeah, that is sort of valiant that they would go on and, you know, continue on with the show and, you know, keep doing what they're doing. Plus, they're going up against other heels, because you have, you know, at the beginning of the show, Brett going up against despicable Shawn Michaels and Hunter Hearst Helmsley. And now you have, you know, angry Rocky Maivia, who is angry about stuff, going up against the British Bulldog, who hasn't really done anything wrong. So it's hard not to cheer for Bulldog in this instance. So I don't know. The whole heel face dynamic just seems pretty off to me.
The thing for
throughout
me,
this entire show,
I just felt that the Hart Foundation were babyfaces. Like, apart from the homophobia bit.
Well,
like,
and that's how I feel too.
Bulldog,
and I'm not supposed to.
Even for an American, it must be hard to watch Bulldog get, you know, screwed by Michaels the way he did, and then have him fighting a heel group here and go against him.
Right? Like, I mean, I understand that I'm like the worst American, but also,
I don't know if you're the worst American.
Well, no, I'm not the worst American. I'm the worst at, like, being super patriotic sometimes, right? But I don't understand how you watch this and not want to cheer for Bulldog and not want to, you know, say, yeah, no, Bret Hart has a point and he's kind of right.
Thing is, they were turning the babyface because Shawn and Triple H were going to be the top heels, and Vince had already decided this. Steve Austin was clearly the top babyface. Brett had no interest in being number two heel. And, you know, Vince knew he was going at this point, so the idea would be that, as it stands, Brett's leaving on good terms. He's going to drop the title, do the right thing, they'll put him over on the way out. You know, thank you, Brett, off he goes. And then the Hart Foundation turns babyface because he thinks they're all going to stay. You know, obviously only one of them stayed in the end, but he thinks they're all going to stay, and they would feud with the Nation. So that's what this was for. this was sort of step one towards that. Obviously, so it
is actually in the works that they're supposed to be baby faces, because that would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, yeah. That's the direction they were going towards. It just obviously doesn't happen.
So Bulldog, Anvil, and Owen were probably going to stick around. If Anvil,
they were going to stick around.
If Anvil hadn't signed another exclusive contract with an indie promotion.
You don't know that already happened by this point.
I know, I'm just joking because he did it again. You know what he's like.
Right.
So we get our two here. We get shown the ending of the IC title tournament in the stills. Steve Austin comes out to meet Vince in the ring. Vince is first trying to ask him, you know, why did he help Owen Hart? And Austin says he doesn't need to answer his questions. Vince is saying, well, you know, you've not got a doctor's note here, so, you know, I'm guessing that you couldn't get cleared. And he said, I never went to see the doctor. And Vince says, we need to sign this waiver that, you know, even if you become paralyzed, it doesn't come back to us. And Austin says, I'll sign your stupid little bit of paper, but you have to give me a contract that has a match with Owen Hart. Vince gives him his wish, and he says that he wants a title match. Then Vince tries to shake his hand, and Austin just looks at him as if, like, no fucking chance.
And he tells him to put his hand away or wipe his ass with it.
Yeah, and then, like, Vince is just hating all of this. And then Farouk turns up in the Titantron with the Nation, and Farouk starts, you know, giving this really big speech about, you know, you don't know what it's like, and, you know, you don't know what it's like to be at the Christmas morning, and your brothers and sisters are opening presents, and they didn't get the new bike they wanted, or we all have to share one jacket to go to school, and I don't really know why.
You could make out a word he said.
Well, the thing is, one of my
subtitles on.
One of my favorite things is trying to decipher Ahmed Johnson promos, and if you can,
if you can
decipher half of Ahmed, Farouk is like a treat. Farouk is easy compared to Ahmed. And then Austin has this great line where he says, ain't a race thing, ain't a colour thing, it's a me kicking your ass thing. And then Austin just shoves Vince just randomly and poses for the crowd, and basically he's going to have to, Vince is going to have to bring a contract. And then he goes over to the announce table and he like fluffs Jerry Lawler's little shoulder pad and then grabs his crown and ball kicks it into the audience. As a guy looks so happy to have Jerry Lawler's crown. Sandra, what did you think of this segment? Austin's always one of your favorite parts of the show. What did you think of this segment?
Oh, Austin's excellent. I mean, I'm still kind of on Vince McMahon's side because he's super not wrong about not wanting Steve Austin to wrestle and potentially become paralyzed, right? So I still kind of feel that Vince has a point when he's like, yeah, so you need to sign this waiver so that you don't sue the company. Like, really, I mean, the fact that the waiver is even an option is kind of suspect, because it kind of seems like the answer should be no, you cannot wrestle, your neck is broken, that is a bad idea. Because, I mean, like we said last week, the story nowadays would be you are retired, that is the end of the story. Like, there would never be a rise of Steve Austin in 2017, for, you know, for better or worse, because obviously they want to protect the wrestlers and they want to protect their health and all of that kind of thing. But I mean, Austin's just excellent here, saying, you know, I ain't been to the doctor, so I ain't got no piece of paper, jackass. And like, he's just egging Vince on. Vince is having a very rough night with being called all sorts of names. And I mean, just the dynamic between Austin and Vince is very interesting. Vince's role on the show is definitely changing, right? Like, because Shawn Michaels in the opening promo was calling out Vince as the owner of the company. And this is very clearly a, you know, Vince McMahon overarching decision. It seems like the authority structure on the show is shifting quicker and quicker every week, because you still have Sergeant Slaughter out there trying to maintain order in situations like the Nation of Domination versus, you know, like when the Nation of Domination are all brawling, or when, you know, there's all sorts of chaos, you have Slaughter trying to maintain order, but Slaughter's not making these overarching decisions. And instead of having President Gorilla Monsoon, it's very clearly really Vince McMahon doing it. And they're bringing that onto screen. So it's interesting to see that shift, but I really like Austin's reactions, and just, he's so angry about everything. Like, he doesn't want to shake Vince's hand. He doesn't, you know, and Austin's smart too. He says he's not going to sign the waiver until Vince presents him with an actual contract. He's not going to have a handshake deal. He's not going to trust him. He doesn't trust anybody.
A handshake deal with,
I don't trust anybody.
A handshake deal with Vince McMahon? No thanks.
Right? And Austin's right not to, you know, believe him. He's right to say, no, I need a contract. And then Farouk coming on the Tron it is interesting. Like, the dissension between Farouk and Austin makes a lot of sense, obviously, because Austin cost Farouk the Intercontinental title. And, I mean, Farouk's just kind of going off about, like, how you don't know what tough is. He seems very concerned with Steve Austin's ass. Like, and saying the word ass, because he's like, you know, you use the word ass, you think you're tough, and the way we use the word ass is your ass belongs to me and the nation. It belongs to Farouk. So he really wants to own Steve Austin's ass for some reason that I'm not really super aware of. But, you know, I mean, it was a classic Farouk kind of shouty promo, and I'm intrigued by the multiple stories going on, because Austin, who can't wrestle and who can't actually, you know, do much physically in the ring, is having these multiple ongoing stories, you know, with the Hart Foundation and now also with the Nation of Domination, and he can't really do anything about it yet. So it's interesting to see how it's simmering.
I did also like that he, Austin, you know, put across to Vince, you know, you're not going to take away what I've worked 8 years to get to. That was a good line. James, what do you think of this segment? Was this, where was this in the trajectory of Austin and Vince, do you think?
It was kind of it was good, because all Steve Austin in this era is good, but it's kind of a placeholder, you know, that it's getting to the point where you want to see Austin back in the ring and, you know, kicking ass again, and he's not quite at that point yet. And, you know, the dialogue's really good and it's getting there, but it's not the best stuff they've done, I don't think. I mean, I do like some of the verbiage. I like the stuff about the doctor's note. I thought that was really funny. You know, because Austin is a comedic genius. He's hilarious.
He really is.
Always. Babyface, heel, no matter who he's working with. But yeah, I didn't like the Farouk stuff. I thought it was pointless. I understand why it was there, given what happened to Bad Blood, but who wants to see Austin working with Farouk, you know? Because he drags everyone down.
Poor Farouk. So at this point, there was... Obviously, the screw job gave us Mr. McMahon, but at this point, is there any thought process to what we have something here with Austin kind of against Vince? Nothing.
No. That decision was made when, and you know, we're kind of going to skip ahead here a little bit, I guess. But when Vince did the Brett Screwed Brett interview and got a shit ton of heat from it, and you know, started to get booed at the arenas, because Vince thought when he did that thing he'd be the babyface. You know, he's the underdog, this guy who's been bullied by this nasty wrestler, you know, bullshit. And at that point Vince went, oh, you know what, these people fucking hate me, so fuck it, I'll just go with it, I'll be the heel.
So you mean a McMahon thought that he would be the babyface in a situation where he clearly looked like the heel? That doesn't sound like it continued in the family at all.
Indeed.
Apart from, but it's funny though, because like, you get Shane and Stephanie and Vince who are all heels, and then you get the one McMahon that just can't be a heel, and that's Linda. Like, she's like,
and she works for Donald Trump. So what does that tell you?
The world's fucked.
Yes.
I think I assume that Vince was going to, initially Vince thought he was going to come back on commentary post Survivor Series.
Oh yeah, like there was no intention at all for Vince and Austin to be the feud. He was there because he was the voice of authority, and people knew that he was the real voice of authority. So again, it's to add realism to the Steve Austin legitimate injury situation. It was never intended to be anything like it became.
There's so many, like, lucky things that they stumble upon at points. Like, you know, imagine they hadn't done the Austin Vince stuff, but, like, the story's already kind of programmed in. Up next, we get Owen Hart defending his Intercontinental title against one of Sondra's top five favourite wrestlers in WWF, Road Warrior Hawk.
You're kidding me.
She loves Hawk. Go ahead, Sondra.
Is it because he can't sell?
I love him because he's shouty. I don't love watching him wrestle. I just
like
watching
his
him
promo?
Shout. Yes.
About the loogie stuck in the throat?
Yes. Well, Owen Hart, you and the Hart Foundation are like a loogie stuck in my larynx that I just can't seem to expel. Oh. And he says that Owen's going to be the shortest Intercontinental Champion that ever was, because it only takes one to get rid of that loogie.
Yeah, good play on words. You know, Hawk, very good.
I love the idea. Like, imagine, like, you know, there's a big tournament for the Intercontinental title, and Owen Hart's going to lose it to Road Warrior Hawk.
I don't understand why. Like, I mean, I do love Hawk and his shouty promos, but why is Hawk getting an Intercontinental title match
just
right now?
1997.
Apparently so. Apparently that's the only reason. The Headbangers can't get a rematch after they just lost their belts.
And won a rematch here.
and won a rematch here, but Hawk gets a random Intercontinental title match for reasons, I guess. Like, it doesn't make sense. I don't understand why all these people are getting title shots. Why have Los Barriquas had multiple tag title shots recently? Why did the Godwins get a title shot and then they fucking won? I'm
diversity.
Still mad.
LOD had a big feud with Davey and Owen, though.
They did, but that doesn't mean that he should challenge for the singles belt that Owen
beat
holds.
Him before.
Well,
he holds a win over him.
See, this is why we need the encyclopedia of James Dixon to remind us that Road Warrior Hawk pinned Owen Hart at some point. But luckily, Owen Hart would not continue breaking necks here, and that didn't happen. It ends up that Bulldog comes. Oh no, the Godwins! Sorry, the Godwins come down
to ruin my life. Yes,
to ruin your life again. A second Godwin segment in one night, Sandra. You must have been thrilled.
I'm not okay with it. Not okay with it at all.
So Hawk ends up getting nailed with a slop bucket. Owen gets the cover, but it's only a two count because, you know, Hawk is not going to be pinned by one slop bucket hit. Animal runs down to like a huge pop, like. LOD
are so way over, aren't they? LOD.
I, you know, Vince Russo can go and suck a fuck. Like LOD, like I was, see when this bit was on, I was just thinking, I fucking love LOD. Like they're American badasses that just try and beat people up. They don't sell, and I kind of like it, and I can't really explain why.
They're a great team. They're great. I love them in '97.
And
you know, Kenny, when we started Retro Raw and when LOD came back, I was like, ugh.
And not
I don't
as in
care about
a rush.
No, not, it was like, ugh, I don't care about these guys because I just, you know, I never had any connection to the Road Warriors or Legion of Doom or whatever. I just didn't care that much, but they have won me over with all of their shouting and just being absolutely mental. And I really like that about them.
They
kind of are. And if, you know, if I'm watching this with no preconceived notions and going, yeah, no, they're actually really cool. And I don't even have the nostalgia of, you know, when Road Warriors were great or anything behind it, it means they're an effective team.
I think that they are, like, because I know it's kind of like the WWE history, you know, whatever they talk about as well. LOD came back in 97. It wasn't quite working. Yes, it was.
It was, though.
Like, they were.
They say that to defend their own stupidity, though.
Yeah, when they tried to... Oh, wait till you see the turn, Sandra. Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
It's so bad. Okay. Anyway.
Speaking of bad, the finish of this... Oh, my God. Hawk goes up to the top and then realizes he's in the wrong corner. So he climbs down and goes up to the opposite corner to hit his stupid clothesline. And then he gets hit with the horseshoe or some shit. Kinda.
Mm-hmm. Loosely hit with that.
Fuck. I mean, it looked so bad. So
and Owen doesn't even hit another finishing move or anything.
No,
he just pins him.
Owen's a zombie in this match, though. No, you can tell, like, Pillman dying's affected, as understandably. You know, and you can tell he's just kind of going through the motions here. Either that or he's working with Hawk and he's devastated about it.
Do you think the thing that really, like, I totally forgot about it is that, like, the arena that they were in for Bad Blood is the arena that Owen dies in 2 years later.
Yeah.
Freaky. Oh, is it really?
Yep, Kansas City.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, like LOD in 97, a quite defensive LOD in 97. They came back, I thought they were fucking great in that six-man Chicago street fight. Hawk brings out the kitchen sink.
He does.
That was so cool.
And then, like, you know, I thought they were a great tool in the kind of war of America versus the Hart Foundation. Much more effective than the fucking Patriot.
Well, I mean, the bar's not high there.
Fucking Patriot. I hate him.
It's time now, isn't it?
It is time to talk about... So, let's throw it to you, James. Explain the mindset behind this, why it happened, and just... Oh, this is so bad, but go ahead.
This is horrendous.
I mean, the mindset behind it is... We want ratings, you know, and Vince had seen that the things getting ratings were shock TV and, you know, real life, you know, not just grief, but real life, anything was working on TV. So that's what he wanted to become, you know. So if it was anything other than a ratings ploy, they'd have done it at the start or they'd have done it, you know, somewhere else without building up to it. But he absolutely knew what he was doing. And after promoting it throughout the entire show, see the dead wrestler's wife crying on the air, you know, essentially.
Do you know the one that got me the most is before they go to the break before the interview, and they cut to the house and they just close up on her, devastated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and
I mean, she's sitting there looking like she's about to cry and like she's been crying all day because, you know, her husband just died yesterday.
Yeah, less than 24 or only just 24 hours ago.
Now, did Vince pressure her into doing this?
No, so as the final commercial was on, he gave Melanie one last chance to still back out of it. And he said, you know, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. It's not too late. And she said, no, it's fine. But... she was kind of under pressure to do it because she knew she needed to comply with Vince because Vince had promised to honor Brian's contract for 3 months and put out a Tribune magazine, which she would get all the money from. And she knew that he wanted her to do it and that she would be relying on him to pay bills and, you know, buy food. So she had to do what he wanted. Otherwise, because if she's backed out, then all of a sudden Vince might be less inclined to give her these things. So she didn't really have a choice. Even though
I'm sure she's not thinking super clearly either.
No doubt.
Do you know the one line, for whatever reason, that just was, for me, was just too much, was like, so Vince is sitting there and, you know, Vince is trying to act as sort of like despondent about it as possible. So, yeah, you know, it seems like on air he's trying to not, he's trying to make it as genuine as he is able to do. But then he says to her, so Melanie, have you thought about, you know, how you're going to provide for your children as a single mother? And I was like, are you serious?
Oh, yeah. Some of the verbiage is horrible. And one thing that I should make clear as well with this is that Vince knew, even if the world didn't necessarily know, that prescription meds had been found by Brian's deathbed. And he wanted to use Melanie to help him refute reports that the death was somehow related to steroids or this rampant underground drug culture in the WWF, which there was, but he didn't want the world to know that. So he was trying to corner her into blaming Brian for having overindulged. And, you know, it was really, when you know that, and then you listen to some of the things that he's saying, and you can see him sort of trying to back her into these corners and get her to admit certain things, it's even more disgusting, actually. I mean, because he says, doesn't he? It's like the second question in or the third question in or something. And he's like, is there anything you want to say to aspiring athletes who get hurt and have to resort to prescribed medication? And, you know, Brian had to take a lot of medication, this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. He asked her about prescribed medicine and if there's anything she wants to say about it. And at that point, I'm like, what are you doing to this woman? Because he's sort of implying that, you know, the painkillers had to do with Brian's death. I mean, the first question he asks her is, you know, what happened? Like, just tell us what happened. And she's like, there was a problem with his heart attack and his sleep, you know, until tests are back, it's inconclusive. Okay, like, I don't like the fact that she's out here, but okay, so she's providing an update, letting us know what happened to her husband, as far as she knows. Okay. And then the second question he asks her is about, oh yeah, so your husband was a mad druggie, right? Like,
basically, yeah.
Like, that's essentially what he says. And it's like, how are you even expecting this woman to respond? And, you know, she kind of breaks down and she says, you know, all athletes experience a reliance on pain medicine. And she wants this to be a wake-up call and she doesn't want it to happen to anyone else. But, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, James, but the drugs were not the cause of Brian Pillman's death. Like, that wasn't even...
Oh, they were...
Well, but I mean,
involved.
Like... Well, I'm sure that they were involved, but, like, it wasn't an overdose of pain medication that killed him.
It was an accumulation of medication, really. You know, he'd been kind of... He'd been riding that line for a long time, and everybody knew that it was coming. Everybody knew it was coming. And he'd changed completely, and he'd started to act like his character in his private life at home with Melanie. And see, there's a lot more to this, though. I mean, other than what you've got to remember is that, like, Vince is trying to use Melanie to be his chief line of defense against the upcoming media circus. But at the same time, Melanie's trying to use this to look like the grieving widow, because what people don't realize is that the child she was pregnant with wasn't Brian's. It was the person she was having an affair with, and that Brian and Melanie had actually split up and she'd got a restraining order against him. And she doesn't want the public to see that side of things either, because she wants all this support and money and help from from everybody in the industry, and no one's going to help her if they know that she's been cheating on Brian with this guy, who she married about a year later, by the way. And believe me, that's all first-hand and factual, because, you know, I've covered this quite a lot in various different ways, so it's an issue quite close to my heart, as it were. And yeah, there's a lot of bullshit going on from both sides.
Because there's also the thing of that Pellman had a kid with his previous girlfriend, who then killed herself.
Yeah.
So that kid was then with Melanie, I'm guessing, right? And the other kids or something.
So Brian had a couple of kids and Melanie had a couple of kids, and I think they had the one that she was pregnant with was their first one. It may have been their second one. Brian definitely had kids to other women, but they all kind of lived with Brian and Melanie. So a lot of the kids were actually her stepkids. So it was quite a strange dynamic in terms of it wasn't all Brian and Melanie's kids staying at that house. And like Melanie claimed there was like five kids, including the one that was coming, but one of them hadn't lived with them for years because of, you know, issues with Melanie. And Melanie, for all what Vince did to her here, it's not particularly nice, because she is still grieving regardless of the situation between her and Brian. But Melanie's no saint and shouldn't be getting too much sympathy either, because she did some pretty horrific things before, during, and after this whole incident as well. So I don't have as much sympathy for her as I'm sure you guys do watching this back.
Yeah, fuck Melanie, what a bitch. Let's move on.
Well, you know, she spent all the money that was supposed to go to helping the family on... It all went up her nose. And then the kids saw nothing. They were living on hand-me-downs. The kids only survived because Brian's sister took them in and looked after them. You know, it's not the happy ending story that people maybe hope for. All those memorial shows that the wrestlers put on for Melanie, they stopped doing them in the end because they realized what she was doing. You know, she wasn't with the kids. She was with this other guy. She was taking the money to fund a drug habit. And you could say, oh, well, you know, she had it hard because her husband died. No, she'd already left him at this point. They'd been in a bad way for a while. He was having to go to therapy, like I think it was like anger therapy or something like that, because she wouldn't be around him. And yeah, the whole thing was a mess, a real mess. And it's not as cut and dry as it appears.
There we go. They do play a tribute video afterwards, which is actually quite nice. And pretty much probably should have just played the tribute video at the start and could have avoided this.
I get that this was a ratings ploy, but the tribute video would have been fine. Like, it's jarring to have this really super nice video package and, like, talking to his actual wife. And it is kind of jarring after he's been such a piece of shit on TV lately, right? And so, I don't know, it all just kind of feels like, I don't know, the whole thing just left me with a really bad taste in my mouth. Because, I mean, regardless of how messy things were, like, backstage between Brian and Melanie, I just feel like it puts the company in kind of a bad light to put this, you know, grieving widow on TV. Like, it doesn't
horrible.
Make the company look good.
Yeah, they look terrible. And Vince kind of regretted it as well in the end. Especially when her last line's like, I hope no one else has to die. And he's like,
I do think there's a thing though of like I think the segment was bad, but at the same time I'm guessing that like if you're Vince or you're in the WWF at that point, like the amount of high pressure stuff that's going on every Monday or every week and like bad blood's just been and Pillman's died, like sometimes you make decisions which you maybe regret later. So I don't necessarily think that, you know, I don't think Vince, I mean it was obviously a ratings ploy, but I think that probably it looked a lot worse when it went out than in his head that he thought it was going to be. He's probably thought, oh, I'll do this interview. You know, it'll be nice to have her kind of pay tribute to Brian. We can look a bit babyface and that'll be fine. And then you do it and it's like, oh, we look like we've just railroaded her and made her cry and we look horrible.
Yeah, I mean, he never actually said sorry for that either, really, because when he went on that off the record, like a year later, he was and Michael Landsberg asked him, he's like, do you regret that? And he's like, not at all. Like, actually, there's very little in my life I regret. I don't regret that whatsoever. And it's like, what? Come on. Come on, pal. You know? And then he's like, well, he had a heart attack. He had a diseased heart. And it's like, no. No, Vince. You knew what you were doing. You exploited Brian's death and Melanie's grief for your, you know, benefits to try and beat Ted Turner. That's what it comes down to.
So up next, we're supposed to get the Truth Commission against a very, very young Matt and Jeff Hardy. But Kane comes out to make his Raw debut with a returning Paul Bearer. Kane chokeslams both the Hardys. He throws Jeff out the ring so he can throw Matt on top of him. Paul Bearer gets in the mic again for the first time in a while and says that to the fans, you know, your Undertaker forced me to bring in his brother Kane. Yes, oh yes, he's alive. The 20 years of suffering and hiding is now over. And then Bearer vows to destroy every wrestler in the WWF until he gets to the Undertaker. And then he finishes the promo by welcoming the Undertaker to his worst nightmare. I fucking love Kane. He's so good here. James, what do you remember about initially when you saw Kane sort of debut at Bad Blood and then come out here and just destroy a couple of wrestlers?
Coolest motherfucker ever when he debuts. He was great. He looked so badass. And, you know, he comes down, he rips off the cage, he beats the fuck out of Taker. Oh, man, he looked amazing in that bright red. I loved his mask. I loved Kane. I think he's crap now, but I liked it then. That era Kane, though, awesome. Awesome. Until he started fanning around with X-Pac and changing his gear. But, yeah, he was great. One thing I did find interesting about this segment, though, is Paul Bearer mentions this. The Kane goes over the Kane story again and recaps it all, and then mentions that he's only got one eye. What happened to that?
Was that another emotional scar?
Is that what we're playing it off as?
Initially,
maybe it grew back, right? That happens to eyes.
Sometimes eyes can grow back.
Of course they do.
You never know. Sandra, I'm guessing you were pretty much in love with this.
Oh, of course I was in love with this. Are you kidding me? Like, it's supposed to be the Hardy Boys versus the Truth Commission, which, you know, fair enough. Adorable baby Hardys versus Truth Commission, who are so shite that I love them. But of course, like, interrupting and the lights going out, and it's, oh my gosh, it's actually just Kane, and he's going to batter people and throw Jeff onto Matt on the outside, and that's great. And I like the Hardys are already getting just, like, thrown about and, you know, landing on each other.
Later he'd marry Matt's girlfriend, and they'd feud, and it was, you know.
I mean, Dumb shit. The days.
Oh, yeah.
Who would have thought here that the baby Hardys were going to become a big, big part of the Attitude Era? Nobody
I know. It's so cute to see them here. It's just like, I mean, they're Matt and Jeff Hardy. They're just two guys. They might as well be, you know, whoever in the light heavyweight division. They just don't matter at all. They're just there to get battered by Kane, and it's wonderful. And hearing Paul Bearer speak again and go ahead and laugh at me. Here's your chance. Go ahead and laugh at me. And the one you should be laughing at is your so-called phenom. I mean, I don't think it's any surprise to anyone. I'm pretty sure Kane is supposed to be the heel here, but oh boy, do I love Kane. I love him, especially if he's going to batter the Undertaker. Like, that's even better. So I cannot wait to see where this Kane stuff goes, because, like, I know the general trajectory. I knew that Kane was going to debut, but I mean, seeing him look like such a badass coming out and just battering everyone and, you know, I don't know. I love him.
What do you think of him compared to modern Kane?
Well, I mean, I don't know that there's really any comparison. Now, I like modern Kane.
But you like modern Kane ironically.
Modern Kane is pretty shit, right? Like, well, I mean, I don't know if I would say I like him ironically. I like the Kane that was in Team Hell No. And I see Kane as a continuation of that character. And whenever he comes back, I like to see him because I have a fondness for Kane.
I
love corporate Kane too.
He was very funny when he was having to do the HR stuff on Seth Rollins. You know, yes. Seth Rollins is trying to say, like, he's the worst, and Kane's like, how do you feel? Do you need me to take you to HR? And that was so good. But, like,
I see corporate Kane as an extension of what he learned from Dr. Shelby. So in my headcanon, it all makes sense.
The problem with corporate Kane was he was very funny in backstage vignettes, but sadly he then had to wrestle.
Yeah, those were the unfortunate times, for
sure. Well, this is why Kane's good hit in this era, because he doesn't wrestle, he just comes out and beats the shit out of people.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is he hasn't really done a whole lot yet, right? Like, he's tombstone to The Undertaker.
Give him a chance, it's only been a day.
Well, no, but that's the great thing, though. I'm saying, for how little he's done, I am super into Kane. He hasn't had to do any more than this.
And the good thing is, between now and WrestleMania, you can just rest assured the storyline with him is good. Like, it all makes sense, it's all fun.
He's good for at least a year, isn't he, from this point, I would say?
Yeah, I think he's good up until... Yeah, I mean, I still think he was very effective up until kind of 99, and then it really sort of, like, he just becomes, like, kind of like another guy, yeah. Kind of. But, yeah, I mean, he's got some...
He definitely doesn't feel like just another guy right now. I mean, when Paul Bearer says, you know, starting with these boys tonight, we're going to walk through the World Wrestling Federation, take each wrestler one by one, and destroy them until we reach you, Undertaker. I love this path of destruction on the way to, like, finally getting revenge for the Undertaker who set fire to their childhood home.
Apparently.
Apparently.
Main event time is Bret Hart versus Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and it's interesting because I think if you know 1994 Bret Hart and 2000 Triple H had had a match, it'd have been very good. But it's not the two eras that we got.
It's nothing, is it?
We got Bret on the way out. He doesn't really care anymore. Hunter, who's rubbish.
Because he's not good.
Because it's like in wrestling when you're on your way out. I mean, James, you know more about wrestling and ring than we do, but like when you're on the way up, you kind of have to put in your best performances to get to the top, right? Whereas
not in WWE.
Well, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. He didn't have to do that because he was pals with Sean, so he could just be
good for him.
Be shite.
Man, anybody else would do the same thing in his position because it's easy to criticize. Well, you know, he was friends with the top guy and he became friends with the boss and then he married the boss's daughter, and it's like, yeah, I'd have done all the same things if I could have as well.
The thing is, if I did that, I'd fully expect people in a podcast to be ripping me for it. And I'd be like, go ahead.
I'm sure he doesn't give a damn.
I will go
yeah,
on
I'm
my
sure
private
he's
jet.
Fine with it. I mean, he's super rich, and now he, you know, has the keys to the kingdom. So, I mean, good on him for that.
And
I
to
suppose.
Be fair,
it doesn't stop him from being shite in 1997 and stinking up my TV.
He's bringing back War Games, so I can't really be too angry.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I'll never criticize him. He's done good things for this business.
Starcade, War Games, and brought in like every indie wrestler we all want. So, long live Hunter.
Caused some headaches over the months, but yes.
Yeah. So
I find JR's burial of Bret in this match interesting.
Yes, talk a little bit about that.
Well, he just starts. It's obvious that JR knows that something's happening at this point because he starts calling Bret like too predictable, you know, things like that, and these little subtle hints of there's something going on. I mean, that's been happening since Bret came back at Survivor Series, like, you know, a year ago nearly, when they were calling him old and lost a step and not as effective.
And what's interesting is, the only time, because I didn't really know what age Bret was, I don't think until the Power Slam came out right after it that said I quit on it. And I had no idea he was 40. Like, Bret does not look 40, he doesn't act 40. Like, I would never have, if you put him beside guys like Steve Austin and all that, I wouldn't have said he looked really any older.
No.
So, it's only when, it's interesting watching it back because when we've been watching this back, and I think Sandro Pro agrees, like, it feels like they put a lot of digs in at him from pretty much the beginning.
Yeah, because Vince had buyer's remorse, though.
Yeah, and the whole time it's just kind of, it almost feels like the screw job has to be a plan. I know it's not, but the whole time, if you watch it, it feels like it's all culminated, something like that.
I think Vince knew from day one that he was going to get one good year out of Bret, and then one last good year, and then renegotiate. Like that's, I think it was always Vince's intention and not honor that deal, you know, well before any of the Montreal stuff. He did not want to sign that deal. And even on the day of signing it, he was kind of held against the wall with it and had no choice by Carl DeMarco negotiating for Bret and Bret saying, no, I want this signing and doing this way or I'm not going out there to do that promo that he did. And Vince immediately starts trashing him or instructing other people to trash him and does subtle things to throughout the year to destroy his character, you know, turns him heel. Makes him anti-American, then makes him racist, so that Nation of Domination thing they did. Makes him homophobic. All of this stuff. So, yeah, Vince knew he was going to do this from day one, so this is just a continuation of that, but it's now becoming less subtle and more obvious.
I mean, JR actually says on commentary, Bret Hart is fighting for superiority in the WWF, and he'll have to pry it from Shawn Michaels' hands, which is absolutely baffling when Bret Hart is the champion, and Shawn Michaels is not. Like, how is the champion fighting for superiority over Shawn Michaels, who's just a cunt?
But the thing is, with what they did at SummerSlam, when Shawn, which I still think is such a great ending to a match, but like when Shawn hits Taker with a chair, Shawn and Taker was your main event. There was nothing that Bret was going to do was going to be able to top that. So he was,
especially not if you put him with the Patriot. But
fucking hell. So we get this match, and it's you know, we get Bret versus Hunter. We've got Shawn on the outside. He starts sticking his the Canadian flag up his nose.
And Owen, dancing around, and
Owen Hart and the Anvil come down to keep an eye on things. China's on the outside, we're at Rude. The match is fine. Bret goes to do the sharpshooter. China helps him get to the ropes. And then on the outside, Bret's about to try and put the figure four in the ring post onto Hunter, but then China tries to forearm Bret, but Bret grabs her. And which I thought was interesting, because nobody really got to grab China, and Bret gets to grab her, so. But he does not hit her. Shawn hits Sweet Chin Music on Bret on the outside. Hunter gets the cheap kind of count out victory. The Click get to celebrate on the ramp.
Yeah, they beat him. They beat Bret.
Well, the Hart Foundation are very pissed at the top of the ramp. Sorry, in the ring. So yeah, what did you think of this main event, James, watching it back? Like, it is one of those things, like, Hunter does become really good at one point. You know, he has that kind of 99 to 2001 great period. And Bret's really good, but this just is nothing, really.
I don't think Hunter was good in 97 at all. In 98, he gets better working with Rocky in the middle of the year. But and DX, he was good when DX became babyfaces and less unbearable than they are at this point. But no, the match is crap. I mean, it's a really standard, basic, boring Triple H TV match from this era. Bret is obviously phoning it in. He's not happy with the direction the company's going. He's not happy to be working with Hunter, who he doesn't like, you know, or being involved with anything with Shawn. And he's just generally, and understandably as well, upset about what's happened with Brian. He was also furious about what they did to Melanie. You know, he didn't like that at all. It didn't sit right with him. But, you know, it's just a match, isn't it? It's just nothing. But the thing you mentioned about the Canadian flag's interesting, though, because Shawn actually talks about it on that New Attitude Era DVD, or the 1997 DVD, as it actually is, which I don't know if you've seen that yet, but it's...
Oh, but I thought I got a wee copy of that through the post. I thought, oh, great, Dawn of the Attitude Era, I'm looking forward to watching the documentary. They sent me two of disc two.
You can borrow mine if you wish.
Thank you.
But it's basically just a round table with a couple of the guys who were there and Charles Wright talking about The Godfather.
Clearly, some guys who were there and Charles Wright.
Well, but the thing is, he was there, but they're talking about The Godfather, and he was not around.
He was Kama Mustafa at that point.
Yeah. So it's like, who gives a shit what the Kama Mustafa thinks about anything? But Shawn talks about it, and he's like, oh, I knew that, like, the American flag, people cared about it, and you couldn't do that, but I didn't really put two and two together that in Canada they felt the same way.
It's like, well, oh my gosh,
dumb as fuck, or, you know, or you're full of shit. So it's probably a combination of both of them things. But yeah, I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah,
he did admit to that he shouldn't have done that.
I mean, it's funny because there's, from what I've heard, and this is obviously something I need to work on for January, is that Shawn does not have a very clear memory, or does not want to, about kind of 97.
Elective.
Which is tough, because I guess if you were working in 97, it's going to be tough to remember what happened on every single day and separate it all.
Especially if you're in the States, Shawn Michaels is in half the time when he's out performing.
I don't know what you mean, Sandra. You mean when he had some vitamin C?
Oh, Shawn admits to what he was doing at the time. You don't stop trying to babyface yourself with him.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
My favorite wrestler of all time, Shawn Michaels, is coming over to me.
I can't wait to meet him, Kenny. Get him a sign each copy of Titan.
I'm going to get you to come to Glasgow, though, since it's the last show and you meet him afterwards.
Try and keep me away.
Strategic meeting. Sandra, main event, Bret Hart and Hunter. A weird match to watch.
Weird match, especially, again, if I'm supposed to see Bret Hart as still a heel for some reason, even though he doesn't seem like a heel to me. I mean, they're just, the Hart Foundation are straight up baby faces, in my opinion, at this point. But it was Hunter Hearst Helmsley match, right? The most interesting thing about it is that Finkel announces him as Triple H, I believe, for the first time. I don't think we've ever heard him announced as Triple H for matches. And you can tell that on commentary, JR and Vince and everyone, they're like, Triple H, as he'd like to be known. And they all seem kind of awkward about calling him Triple H instead of Hunter Hearst Helmsley now, which, I mean, it makes it a lot easier for me because now I don't have to keep trying not to call him Triple H because that's what I'm so used to. But I mean, yeah, it was basically just the antics of, you know, everyone on the outside. The match itself was not good, and it's just kind of a bummer because I don't understand, like, Helmsley beating Bret Hart here, even by count out, it's ridiculous. Like, Bret is the champion and Bret's actually good and interesting, and Hunter Hearst Helmsley is not. He is the Baron Corbin of 1997. I stand by that comparison.
I agree with that.
The parallels are there, though. Like, they really, really are. And, I mean, Hunter has
more
hair.
Well, Baron Corbin's
like,
got no friends, though. So.
Right.
That's the
difference. Yeah,
Baron Corbin can't politic as well as Hunter could.
Yeah.
No. But it just...
And Triple H does have better hair. I'll give him that.
He does have better hair than Baron Corbin. That's true. But he's just so dull. He's so dull. And China's, you know, the most interesting part about their act, but she doesn't really get to do much because no one can get retribution on her. And she is sort of stationary and doesn't do a lot. Like, I like China, but, you know, she basically just, like, hits someone and then stands there. So there's only so far that can make Hunter Hearst Helmsley more interesting. He's just not.
So James, what we do on the Retro Raw Rundown is at the end of the show, we all do a thumb. Is it a thumbs up show, a thumbs in the middle, or a thumbs down? Where would your thumb go for this one and why?
Very original concept, Ben.
Thanks, pal.
No problem, mate. My thumb couldn't be higher, but I think this is probably my favorite ever episode of Raw.
Ever?
As hard as that is to believe, because the wrestling's the shits. In terms of the pure sports entertainment aspect of it, this is everything about, you know, that was not necessarily good, but interesting about the Attitude Era. You know, you've got this great Steve Austin segment. Well, not great, but good Steve Austin segment. Steve Austin's great in it. You know, you've got this really interesting segment at the start where the curtain's lifted on kayfabe, which you guys obviously didn't enjoy it watching it back, but I thought it was fascinating at the time and still do to this day. And, you know, when you watch it in context, you've got the Melanie thing, which is appalling, but it's still like you can't take your eyes off it. You want to see kind of how it plays out, which I guess is the idea. It is a car crash. The Cornette promo is superb. You know, you've got these interesting little things happening, like Kane debuting and, well, not debuting, but, you know, debuting on Raw and, you know, a new look for Mark Merrow. Everything's fresh and different and interesting, and there's so much happening that, like, those 2 hours just fly. I think this is the best Raw of all time. I think it's right up there.
There you go. I'm also a thumbs up. I do not think it's the best Raw of all time. I really love the Madison Square Garden Raw, actually. But, I think this is a great episode in terms of the DX and Hart Foundation stuff was fascinating. I still think that Brett saying that Shawn Michaels barebacked his way to pay-per-view main events might be one of my favourite lines ever. The Headbangers getting to beat the Godwins in a big brawl with tons of teams is quite fun. The Cornette promo was good. Mark Merrow, I like Mark Merrow's gimmick. I don't care what anybody thinks. I like seeing the weird match with Davey Boy and Rocky Maivia. The Austin stuff was really good. Road Warrior, Hawk and Owen Hart is just a joy of shiteness. Kane's great. And then the main event was fine. So yeah, thumbs up from me. Sandra, I'm fascinated to see where your thumb would go for this.
I didn't like this episode.
Wow.
Thumbs down. Like, maybe to the middle, maybe because of the, you know, the Jim Cornette promo was good and Kane was awesome, but overall, thumbs down. I don't like the DX stuff. I find it insufferable. I just want to switch off. Like, it's the Hart Foundation and DX stuff, it's not clicking for me because I think the roles are wrong and DX are just so incredibly insufferable that I don't want to see them get beat. I just don't want to see them. So that's kind of a problem. The Headbangers versus the Godwins, like, it should have been for the titles, and the Godwins are still the champions, so I don't like that. Mark Miro versus Miguel Perez, I'm sorry. Like, that's not all that interesting of a concept to me. Like, Mark Miro, I like fine, I guess, but he's bland. And Miguel Perez, I mean, he can just fuck right off. Rocky versus Bulldog was, you know, fine, I guess, but eh. And then, I mean, the only really good thing that I enjoyed was the Stone Cold Steve Austin promo, and that's basically about it. And Kane, like, the Stone Cold Steve Austin promo and Kane I liked, but overall this show was not very easy for me to watch. I didn't like it. It had so much stuff on there that I was just like, why is this happening? And the storytelling just isn't clicking for me right now. So, and I hated the Melanie Pillman segment. Like, I hated that they kept referencing it. I hated that they kept showing his house, and it just felt very exploitation. And I didn't like it.
There you go. I think that's one of the interesting things about the show is what, when somebody who has a newer perspective, some weeks it clicks for you, some weeks it doesn't. But James, where can people, if they've been listening to some of your knowledge that you've been flinging out, and they want to go buy some of these Titan books, this is your time to shill and plug to your heart's content. Where can people go?
I'm a terrible shill, but I believe they are available on Amazon. So type in Titan and my name on Amazon, and you will find them all. And I'm also on Twitter, but I have no idea what my handle is. Do you know?
It's JDixonWriter.
Is it? Excellent.
Yeah. Which I assume James Dixon was taken.
I don't know. What is Twitter? What even is Twitter? I don't know.
It's a place for you to find out when new Hasbros are coming out.
Oh, it's worth it for that alone.
So do go on to Patreon, patreon.com/insidetheropes, where you can hear James and I talk a little bit about Brian Pillman and his death and what led up to him, what was going on behind the scenes at Bad Blood. And we'll be back next week when there is a pretty big tag title main event, I think, is next week. And we're on the road to the Survivor Series with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And sadly, we know how it all ends. So yeah, Sandra, where can people find you on Twitter?
Find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. And follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes.
So to play us out, here is the song of Sandra's favourite wrestler. We'll play it one more time because he doesn't really have his own music going forward. Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Bye, everybody.
Yeah. Bye.